This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Not long ago, the combination of tough-on-crime politics and ample budgets led many states to adopt aggressive and, in some cases, expensive corrections policies. At the time, political leaders across the nation bragged about how many criminals they'd locked up and attributed falling crime rates to mandatory sentencing laws like three strikes and you're out. Well, times have changed. Now many states face serious economic problems and tough choices on what to cut. Prison budgets are on the chopping block. For some states, that means fewer guards. For others, it requires closing facilities. Many have reduced or eliminated education and drug treatment programs, and in some states, prisoners are just leaving early. Later in this program, we'll preview tonight's battle at Yankee Stadium, Godzilla versus Ichiro, the showdown between Japan's best-known ball players, and we'll bring you up to date on the progress of the invasion of France by troops from the United States, Britain, and Monaco. At least that's according to the parody newspaper The Monde, which is now on newsstands in Paris. Yes, U.S. Special Forces did liberate Euro Disney. But first, the latest in our series on state budget crunches and tough choices. This week, prisons. What's happening where you live? Given the facts that cuts have to be made, is this the right choice? Do cuts in prison budgets put public safety at risk? We want to hear from you. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us now by phone is John Osment. He's director of South Carolina's Department of Corrections, and it's good of you to join us.
Thank you.
Let's start with the numbers. How much has South Carolina cut from your department's budget?
Over the last 2 years, we've lost over $70 million out of from a starting point of $334 million. We operated this past year with authorized funding of $254 million, but we actually spent, as of close of this fiscal year on June 30th, we will have spent about $27.7 million more than we were appropriated.
What's going on with the number of prisoners in South Carolina?
During that same two-year period of time, we had an increase of about 2,400 inmates. We are operating at about 102% of our capacity. That's a little deceiving because we do have some new housing units that we just have been unable to staff as quickly as we would like to, but we've stopped what I call stop the bleeding with the outflow of officers leaving, and we're seeing more officers stay with us now, and that's one of the things that I just felt like we needed to address when as of January the 15th when we came in.
Now, obviously, you weren't able to cut back as much as you were told to, but where did you cut back?
Well, over the course of the last 2 years, the previous administration had just implemented a series of freezes and retirement incentive programs. No real cuts had been made other than people, functions of the agency were not allowed to replace personnel when they left. Unfortunately, that resulted in some net cuts to security staff. After I had to appear before the Budget and Control Board for the state to explain the $27 million deficit, I was instructed to implement reductions in force, and I've just chosen and drawn a line in the sand that we're not going to cut our security side of the house anymore, and that left the program side of the house to absorb the remainder of the cuts that we're going to be able to implement.
And when you talk about the program side, what does that mean?
Well, we cut about 148 people, eliminated about 148 people, and most of those came from headquarters, accreditation process, the ACA accreditation process that we go through, and then the final area that we cut was education.
Mm-hmm. Now, what has this done? You were talking earlier about holding on to people. Clearly, this all creates morale problems, doesn't it?
Well, there's really two sides of the house. The morale in the correctional officers' ranks had been, I'd say, fairly low for a number of years in South Carolina. Our correctional officers are paid the lowest paid law enforcement officers in the state. The turnover rate there, it's just been horrendous. I'll give you an example. From June of last year till February of this year, we hired 360 correctional officers. We lost 430. You can't can't run a prison system that way. And we had to just draw a line in the sand and let these folks know that you're the most important people in this agency, and you're not at risk anymore. Because if we didn't send that message, we were not going to be able to hire and retain those officers that did come on board with us. So I think we've made some progress in stopping that bleeding. Unfortunately, there's still a budget shortfall, and our budget situation next year doesn't look much better. We're looking at about a 260 to 265 at best operating budget next year, which of course would still leave us, if everything remains the same, at least $10 million short.
Yeah. Are there any other money-saving strategies that you can even think of at this point?
Well, I'm trying to think long-term. My governor has indicated to us, all of us in the cabinet, that the short-term thinking is kind of what puts states in these positions. For example, in South Carolina, our previous administration spent one-time monies on recurring expenses. So the idea of closing prisons or even early releases in South Carolina is a one-time, very small boost in the arm, but it doesn't address the system that has put us in this predicament. And so what we're working on is working with the legislature to develop a systematic approach to developing legislation. We're going to propose legislation, and I think you're going to see some bipartisan support for alternatives to incarceration, which in South Carolina, we're a little bit behind the curve on that. Other states have developed that and used the new technology that's available, like satellite monitoring, telephone monitoring, and even, you know, halfway houses, better than we have.
Mm-hmm.
So we need, my thought on the process is, let's come up with a systemic approach to this problem and look at the 48% of the people who are in the South Carolina Department of Corrections on nonviolent offenses and have never committed a violent offense. And let's see what percentage of that 48% we would feel safe using set criteria, objective criteria, who would we feel safe having in a less restrictive environment. I think that we can develop a step-out program, you know, where a person is sentenced to the Department of Corrections but immediately screened for work release under electronic monitoring or satellite monitoring that will protect the public and reduce the cost to the taxpayer.
Well, Joe Osmond, thanks very much, and good luck to you.
Thank you.
Joe Osmond is director of South Carolina's Department of Corrections, and we head west now for another view. Joining us now is Steve Green, Assistant Secretary of External Affairs for the California Youth and Adult Correctional Agency, and he's with us by phone from his office in Sacramento. Thanks for joining us.
Good afternoon.
I assume budget cuts are having an impact on your state's correctional system as well.
They are. What we're dealing with every day here, but it's still a moving target. The legislature is looking at a lot of different options, and our overall budget is actually proposed to increase in the next fiscal year because of some construction costs. If it weren't for the construction costs, there would be significant reductions. We've identified in the current fiscal year cuts of $10.2 million in the adult corrections budget, and about $1.4 million in the youth corrections budget. For the next fiscal year, we would cut another $63.1 million in the adult budget and $6.7 million in the youth budget.
One of the areas that almost everybody looks to cut when they're facing a crisis is on maintenance, and obviously that's a short-term solution, but doesn't it lead to long-term problems?
It certainly does. Somebody has said that the two ugliest words in the English language are deferred maintenance. And when you run 33 prisons for adults and 11 for youth, you have a huge physical plant, and that plant is not in good shape. And we can pay now, or we can pay a lot more later, and it looks like we'll be paying a lot more later.
Now, one of the policies we mentioned earlier in the program is the three strikes and you're out policy that's there in California. Does that complicate efforts?
It certainly is added to our population. We have about 7,100 of our 160,000 adult inmates are three strikers. As you may know, on March 6th, the U.S. Supreme Court upheld our three strikes law.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to continue to have it with us for the foreseeable future. our prisons are currently operating in the adult system at 191% of capacity.
191% of capacity.
That's correct.
That's going to lead to lawsuits, isn't it?
Oh, yes, we get lawsuits, lots of lawsuits, but we don't really have any choice at this point.
And there's no, in other cases, judges have ordered the release of some prisoners. Is that an option?
That hasn't happened here. There are certainly some legislators who would like us to release some prisoners. The governor is opposed to doing that. And I'm sure you're familiar with the experience that Kentucky had with early release of prisoners. They had to rescind the program because the newly released inmates were raping and robbing again. And we don't want to do anything that would compromise public safety.
Our telephone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us is Alfie, who's on the line from St. Louis, Missouri.
Hey, Neil, how you doing? I love your show. A long-time listener, first-time caller.
Well, thank you.
My question is, how come some of the prisons, I guess back in the old days, a long time ago, were the prisoners maintain the prison itself, like they did the gardening, they did the painting, they did a lot of things that the taxpayers pay for now. And that would be my question, is like, you know, the prisoners, you know, did just about everything. You know, they did a lot of the gardening, they did pick up trash on the side of the road, they did all kinds of things that paid for the maintaining of the prison, and now the prisons are maintained by tax dollars almost 100%, and how come they don't keep doing that?
Stephen Green, is prison labor an option?
Our prisoners do maintain the prisons and also highway road stops and a lot of other things, and they fight fires and so forth. The problem isn't the labor to maintain the prison. The problem is elderly facilities. Our oldest prison was built in 1852, and it's a wreck. The plumbing is shot, and we're talking about serious investments to upgrade it for earthquake protection, if nothing else, but also simply to replace facilities that don't work anymore, and trying to keep the boilers going, trying to keep the sewer systems from leaking, and those are not labor issues, those are capital improvement issues.
Mm-hmm. Okay, all right. Well, hey, thanks a lot for taking my question. I love your show, and you guys are doing a great job.
Well, thanks for listening, Alfie. Appreciate it.
Bye.
What about health services? We just have a little over a minute left, but I wanted to ask you about that. Your state is required to provide those for inmates. Is that also an effect on your bottom line? Has to be.
Well, yes, it does, and it represents a huge, about a fifth of our budget is health services. In response to litigation, we are expanding health services this year by another $64 million. That will bring the total for health services in our system to around $918 million for the fiscal year.
So that's going to keep adding up, and that's not going to go away, particularly if you've got an aging prison population with mandatory sentencing.
That's true. We have an aging prison population. We're bringing in many people for longer terms than we used to because of enhancements in sentencing laws. And also, not only in our system, but any in prison system, the people we get into our system tend to have some serious health problems when they arrive. Many of these people have gone for years without taking good care of themselves and abusing drugs and alcohol. And so biologically, they tend to be 5 to 10 years older than their natural age.
Well, Stephen Green, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Steve Green is the Assistant Secretary of External Affairs for the California Youth and Adult Correctional Agency. He was with us by phone from his office in Sacramento. When we come back from a break, we'll continue talking about tight budgets and how they affect the nation's prison system. 800-989-8255 or send us email totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about the tough choices forced on state prison systems by rocky economic times. You're invited to join the discussion. Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and the email address is TOTN at NPR.org. Joining us now here in Studio 3A is Ryan King, a research associate at the Sentencing Project and co-author of their report, State Sentencing and Corrections Policy in an Era of Fiscal Restraint. Good of you to be with us.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to what we've heard from the California and South Carolina systems and how they're responding to budget cuts. How does that compare to what's happening across the country?
Well, I think that what the experiences in both states are what is going on in all states around the country. I wanted to pick up particularly on something that Director Osment brought up, and he had said short-term thinking put us in this position. I thought that was an interesting way of putting it. The way I've been thinking about this issue for the last year and a half plus now is a choice between short-term fixes versus long-term solutions. The reason why we are where we are now unequivocally is because of sentencing legislation. There's been research that's been done that indicates that the primary drive to the larger prison populations has been not because of increased or decreased crime rates, and it hasn't been fluctuation in crime rates, but it's been sentencing legislation that has been passed throughout state houses across the country. There are more individuals in prison, and the more individuals are in prison longer. In the 1980s, that primary drive was drug legislation. In the 1990s, the shift moved towards violent crime. The mandatory minimums we were referring to, three strikes, truth in sentencing legislation. And so we're in a position now where we have this choice between these short-term solutions or long-term solutions. And it's an interesting conflict that exists. You've got states that need a budget fix, and they need it now. And as the director of South Carolina was saying, they're talking about legislative choices and legislative decisions. Those are long-term fixes, and those are the sorts of things that are going on all around the country. Kansas just last week passed legislation that's going to be diverting certain drug offenders. This also is occurring in other states around the country. And this is a long-term fix. Now, short-term is what the real question, and that's sort of the heart of the matter right now. Some states like Kentucky have decided to just release prisoners outright. I think it should be...
I think we heard that they've stopped that policy.
Right, exactly. And a clarification on that, Kentucky's policy was screening nonviolent offenders. I'm not aware of the exact statistics concerning them coming back into the system. That's something I would have to look into.
It doesn't cost many to cause a political scandal.
Right, that's exactly the case. Yeah. Texas is another situation, and that's been kind of a lot less... public in Kentucky. Texas, instead of releasing prisoners, what they've done, the real big generator of prison population often is parole, which isn't thought about. That's often referred to in criminal justice field as the backdoor entry into prison. Texas has decided over from 2000 to 2001 to switch some of their parole policies, and what they did is essentially they released more prisoners to parole and have revoked less prisoners from parole back into prison, which has led to a significant decrease in their prison population. Some states, such as Ohio and Michigan, have chosen to close prisons, and while other ones are not opening them up.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's get listeners back involved. Our number again, 800-989-8255, and Teresa joins us from Salt Lake City.
Good afternoon. Recidivism nationally stands at 65%. Here in Utah, it stays at 76%. That means three of four inmates return to prison.
Mm-hmm.
Offering education to the prisoners brings the recidivism down to a mere 1%. All that we do to help the inmates prepare for life outside lowers the number of prisoners going back, and thus the cost of corrections.
I'm not sure about the statistics, but the principle certainly seems applicable.
Right, absolutely. The problem is the sort of tension that I was alluding to before is that we've got these states now are facing these short-term need to cut costs and fill these budget gaps. The sort of educational programs that we're talking about that have been shown time and time again to reduce recidivism rates, oftentimes you're asking a state legislature in a time of bitter financial crisis to invest more in education. That's politically very difficult, although the principle, you're correct, is definitely it's something that we need to look into.
Mm-hmm.
We give them education today, and we don't have them back in prison 5 years from now.
Yeah, but it's the budget crisis is today. That's the choice that a lot of people have to make. I understand the question, and I understand your concern, but that's the situation a lot of people are facing. Teresa, thanks very much for the call. And let's go now to Perry, and Perry's in Plantation, Florida.
Good afternoon, Neil. How are you doing?
Okay.
I just want to say that during your introduction, you had asked the question about releasing more prisoners. Is it going to put the public at risk? And something I want to say is that by reducing the budgets for the prisons also places the guards and the inmates at risk because there's a smaller ratio of guards to inmates. So it's not only something that we're going to see outside of the walls, we're also going to see it inside the walls.
Yeah, that seems evident. Yeah,
absolutely. There's no question about that as well. And again, this gets back to the position that we're in now, the short-term decisions, a lot of legislation that was passed in the 80s and 90s that was passed primarily emotionally and without a lot of facts or evidence to support moving in that direction. The bill has come now, and so we're put in this position. But there's no question. I mean, cutting in prison is cutting costs straight off the top in prison. It's hurtful to prisoners. It's hurtful to people who work in there, and it's definitely an issue that needs to be dealt with multifaceted.
Thanks very much, Perry.
Can I bring up another issue, Neil?
Sure, go ahead.
I wanted to reiterate what your guest was saying earlier about the mandatory minimums and thing and the three strikes rules. The case that we saw before the Supreme Court where the gentleman was shoplifting and, you know, that was his third strike. It seems to me that a lot of these laws need to be thought through again. Politicians are there to be tough on crime, but we have to have common sense in there also.
Yeah, that's a question for politicians, not for the prison administrators.
No, I agree, but the public needs to be the ones who are saying, yes, we want you to be tough on crime. However, we want you to be tough on the crime that matters.
Yeah. Okay, thanks very much.
Thank you, Neil.
Appreciate it. And Teresa's earlier point about education, it would seem that drug treatment programs would fall strictly in the same category.
Absolutely, and vocational programs as well, training for job skills, are in the same sort of category. Those are often the first things that are subject to the budget crunch and the first things that are cut, because obviously, as the last caller alluded to, you don't want to be putting people who work in there, or inmates in there for that matter, having their safety jeopardized.
Email we got from Ross Lund. Here in Minnesota, the legislature has discussed eliminating dessert from inmates' meals, as well as eliminating one meal each day on Saturdays and Sundays.
Right. I'd read about that as well. Yeah. But again, I think these are the sorts of things that Director Osment was referring to as short-term solutions. We need to be thinking bigger, or we're going to be having this conversation every couple of years for forever.
Let's go to Michelle, who joins us on the line from Oklahoma City.
Hello, that's Michelle, and I'm a first-time caller. I have a question about possibly making inmates do not resuscitate. So I work in a hospital here in the city, and occasionally what we have are inmates that have been given life sentences that we have to resuscitate because their sentence is life.
I guess that's, and obviously that's all at state expense.
Well, it's expensive.
Yes.
Resuscitate.
And not only the resuscitation, but obviously then keeping them in the hospital for long periods of time on expensive equipment.
Right.
Yeah. That is a question that would seem to fall under the legal category, wouldn't it?
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think you hit upon a greater point, which is what is the state's responsibility to prisoners? This has been debated quite a bit in terms of health responsibilities. But when we're talking about mandatory minimum sentencing, we're talking about three strikes. The gentleman from the Department of Corrections in California alluded to an aging population. We're going to see this as the essence of these laws is that they keep the same sort of people are going in there that would have been in prior to them, but they're keeping them there longer, which means they're older, and that the older prisoners cost often 2-3 times more to take care of, and we run into the sort of situations that you're referring to. These are questions that we've put ourselves in a position to now have to answer.
Interesting question, Michelle. Thanks very much.
Thanks. Bye.
Let's go now to William, and William's in Savannah, Georgia.
Hey, yes, sir.
Go ahead.
Well, my question is about private institutions. We had a few in the state of Missouri. I'm a former corrections officer at a level 5 institution there in Licking, Missouri. And we had a few private institutions. Now, why would that not work for the state to help reduce their budget? Are they just not willing to support the private institution, or is there more law liability there than would be worth the risk?
privatization was put forward as a way to save money?
Right. Well, the jury is still out in terms of cost savings. And it's important to note that a lot of the private prisons, when you're comparing them to state-run facilities, it's an apples and oranges equation because the private prisons oftentimes are able to cherry-pick the prisoners. They're not going to have the most dangerous, the most costly to manage and supervise prisoners. Therefore, oftentimes when they put their balance sheet next to the state's, it looks a little bit rosier than it really, really is. So the jury's still out on that, how cost-effective they really are.
From your point of view as a corrections officer, how do privatized prisons stack up?
Well, like he said, they get to cherry-pick their inmates. Like I say, I was at a Level 5 institution, and we dealt with the worst of the worst. And
that would have been maximum security?
Yes. We had the rapists, the murderers. In a three-year career path, I was stabbed 6 times. I've been bitten. I've had urine and feces thrown on me. I've gone through the ringer. And, I mean, we were outnumbered 157-1, whereas in private institutions, they didn't have that problem. And they could pay their officers well enough that they would actually come back the next day and put up with it.
Mm-hmm.
And they were a lot cleaner, a lot well-maintained, a lot better maintained, as it were. And they didn't have as many problems. We had 6 riots in the first 6 months. And they as far as how they stack up, I'd rather go to work for a private institution than I would a state-funded institution.
No, thanks very much. Good luck.
Appreciate it.
Bob McCullough joins us now. He's president-elect of the National District Attorneys Association, and he's with us by phone from his office in Clayton, Missouri. And good of you to be with us.
Oh, my pleasure.
What reaction do you and your fellow prosecutors have to some of the efforts to reduce costs in state correction systems?
Well, it frankly is pretty frightening at times, some of the proposals that are out there. And the most disturbing ones are those that would essentially open the doors and send people back out on the street. We pay a significantly higher price for putting dangerous people back out on the streets than we do by keeping them in, even though we all recognize it's very expensive to keep people incarcerated.
And obviously the states have to save money somewhere. I'm sure the budgets are affecting the prosecutor's budgets as well.
There's no question about that. It's the budget crisis is hitting everywhere across the country, from the state, the federal, the local level, all the way down, and every particular agency. So there's no doubt about that. I found it particularly interesting that almost everybody has talked about finding long-term solutions to it, and I couldn't agree more. All we're talking about right now is a short-term solution to reduce the budget crunch that we find ourselves in right now. And the only way that I see to do that is to decrease the cost, and the cost is by putting more people out on the streets, more criminals out on the street. When you look at most of the people in prison, and I'm sure we could argue over some, but essentially even the prison corrections people will agree that the people in prison are the ones who ought to be there. These are the violent and repeat offenders. You know, we don't have first-time nonviolent offenders going to the penitentiary in this country, and although there are going to be certainly some exceptions to that, we talk about nearly 2 million people being incarcerated in this country. That's an incredibly small percentage of our first-time nonviolent offenders. So the people who are there ought to be there, and if the answer to solving the immediate crisis is to put them out on the street, it's a very dangerous proposition because we pay an enormous price when these guys are back on the street.
Prisons is the latest in our series on tough choices. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And obviously there's going to be a dispute over the number of people who might be eligible for halfway houses, or as we heard earlier from the director of South Carolina's Department of Corrections, he thought maybe 48% of the people in his system might be eligible as first-time offenders, nonviolent offenders.
Well, as I said, there are going to be exceptions to that across the board, and it's going to be higher in some areas than in others. But generally speaking, what we consider a first-time offender is, you know, not necessarily what they talk about a first-time offender in the penitentiary. You have to keep in mind that when you're running a prison, a first-time offender is a guy who's on his first trip to the penitentiary.
Right, and the,
not a first-time offender. That's right. A guy who, in my county, has probably had at least 2 bites at the apple already before he goes to prison on nonviolent charges.
Yeah. I wanted to ask Ryan King about that.
Well, as far as the prison makeup, there's now in state, federal prison, and local jails about 2 million people. We've just exceeded 2 million, actually. The data was just released last month. And I want to make a note. There's no question that the majority, the largest proportion of people in state and federal prisons are violent offenders. It's close to 50%. However, there's a significant portion that are not. My organization released a report last fall doing an analysis of drug offenders in state prison. There is a little under 500,000. There's about 450,000 drug offenders in state and federal prison and local jails around the country. Of the 250,000 plus in state prisons, 58% had no history of violence and had a high level drug offense. Three quarters had only been convicted of a drug or property crime charge. So I kind of take issue with sort of throwing your hands up and saying that everybody there needs to be there. I believe that there is a significant portion of the prison population. We're spending about $5 billion annually to incarcerate the drug offenders. And I believe that going through systematically and looking at these different offenders and classifying them and categorizing them, there are people that can be released.
Well, I'm sure that Bob McCullough would disagree with that.
Well, and one thing I have to disagree with, and I think you have to separate the two, are the federal and the state systems. Now, the federal system clearly is overloaded with drug offenders. The state systems are not. When I say overloaded, I mean it's that proportion. You know, the 2 million people in prison, probably 1.75 million, if not more, are in state prison system, in the state prison system. And of that, I think the number you just mentioned was about 250,000 are low-level or nonviolent drug offenders, or whatever that classification was. Throwing the federal system in there really throws that out of whack.
Yeah. Here's an email we got from Linda Pritchard in Vancouver, Washington. There are many people in prison today who have been over-sentenced, at least in part to mandatory sentencing laws, who may not be a menace to society. Let's get our judges and juries to exercise more creativity in sentencing these offenders and leave prison space for those who are truly dangerous. And I guess that goes to the issue that we're talking about. But Bob McCullough, do DAs take the prison situation into account when they consider what people are charged with?
Well, we take it into account in determining what our recommendation is going to be, whether we're going to recommend that somebody go to prison or not, certainly.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And as I said, it's a guy who's going to prison here on a nonviolent charge, and I think in most states, and you're going to find exceptions, but generally speaking, people on nonviolent charges going to prison have been through the county jail system. They've been through probation. They've been through various forms of probation before they ever go to the penitentiary.
We're going to come back after a break and take a couple of more questions on the issue of prisons and tough choices faced by diminishing budgets. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Tomorrow, a look at assisted living for the elderly and proposals to reduce abuse in those systems. That's tomorrow on Talk of the Nation. Right now, we're talking about tough choices and prisons, which are, like a lot of other state agencies, are having their budgets squeezed by the crisis affecting many states. Our guests are Ryan King, a research associate for the Sentencing Project, and Bob McCullough, president-elect of the National District Attorneys Association. And let's go back to the listeners. Our next caller is Steve, who joins us from Brainerd, Minnesota.
Good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a bondsman here in the state of Minnesota, and I just left the state capitol with meeting with one of the senators. And one of our proposals is, because of the overcrowding in the prisons, is what we call post-sentencing bonds. It's a theory that we've come up with as far as, we've monitored immigration people for 200 years in this state, and as well as defendants before they go to jail. We don't see any reason why we can't monitor them after, with a bond. And what the cost of the bond would be the cost per day for their sentence. If they were sentenced for 365 days, for example, and they cost $100 in that county, their bond would be $36,500. And if they did, they'd have to report to us and go through screening and whatever conditions were set by the court. As long as they, abided by the conditions, they would be out and be able to get back into mainstream and do their jobs. And if they violated, they would go back to jail, and we would have to pay the courts and their costs for incarceration would be paid for.
Bob McCullough, I wonder if you had a reaction to that.
Well, you'd certainly like to see a lot more detail on that, but we're always open to any way in which we can effectively and appropriately reduce the cost. And if monitoring somebody, I mean, it's similar to monitoring people on through the Department of Probation and Parole. It may very well be a more effective way to do that, and I think it's something worth exploring.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we
and it's determines whether you've got to put somebody out on probation who ought to be in prison. You got to answer that first question, and that is, should they be out in the first place?
Exactly. This would be for low-level offenders, a first-time type of thing that we were talking about, that certain percentage, first-time prison, that type of thing, not for violent crimes or three times, that type of thing.
Ryan King, as you mentioned, as we heard earlier in our conversation with the Director of Correctional Program in South Carolina, the crisis is causing a lot of people to come up with some creative ideas.
Yeah, and I think that it's we're put in a position where we really don't have much of a choice but to do that. Unfortunately, it's why this issue is so important right now is these decisions that are being made are going to have long-term effects, and that these creative decisions that are being discussed need to be thought about. We're trying to get more discussion and thought about it now than 20 years ago when a lot of this legislation and things were passed that put us in this position.
Okay. Steve, interesting idea. Thanks very much.
Yeah. We believe it'll be a long-term answer to the problems. I mean, like I say, the industry's been around for 200 years in this country, and we do pretty well at it now.
Okay.
All right. Have a nice day. Thank you.
Appreciate it. One last question on this. Let's go to Neil, who's with us from San Francisco.
Yeah, first point. People over 45 or 50 or 60 commit much fewer crimes, I believe. Why not just release most of those? Second point, what percentage of our prisoners are aliens, immigrants, legal or illegal? Maybe we should send them all back to where they came from. And a third point, I think 50 years or so ago, rehabilitation and education were favored and were used, but unfortunately it didn't work out very well, as I recall.
Mm-hmm. Bob McCullough, particularly on the question of elderly prisoners, I wonder if you get a reaction to that.
Well, I do. There's no question but that as an individual ages, they commit fewer crimes. That's not a big secret, and it's something we try to work with. We know that when males hit, who commit most of the crimes, but when they hit age 30 and 35, the number of crimes they commit drop off. And so that was part of the reason for the truth in sentencing that we have, where you're required to serve 85%. It put them over that age range. So when they're being released, instead of being released at age 23 or 4, they're being released now at age 35 to 40, where statistically at least they're going to commit fewer crimes, or fewer of them will go out and commit more crimes. So, and I think we have to recognize that in this country, probably 97% of the people who are in prison right now eventually are going to be released. So when we send people off, we've got to send them off with the recognition that they're coming back, and I think age is a factor in that. We've built that into the law in Missouri, and I think in many other states that is built in as a consideration, even on the truth in sentencing. If they hit a certain age and they've still done a significant portion of the sentence, they can be released even if they haven't done the 85.
Okay, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there, but thanks to you both. Bob McCullough, President-elect of the National District Attorneys Association. He was with us from Clayton, Missouri. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And Ryan King, who was with us here in Studio 3A, thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Ryan King, a research associate for the Sentencing Project.